Welcome back to another episode of Out of the Blank Podcast. Eric is back again, and he's got coffee. He's ready to go. He's primed and energized. Eric, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back for the 150th time.
Because we have such a good flow, because you always enlighten me with new topics. Mostly, like, I want to get into some more Howard Hughes stuff. You got any more Howard Hughes juicy details?
Well, I think I'm kind of, like, exhausted my at-hand repertoire of Howard anecdotes. But, I mean, if you wanted to, like, discontinue the interview and give me like half an hour to like check some stuff.
No, we're good. Don't worry about that.
Okay.
I'll just email James Elroy and try and get it from him.
Yeah. See. Yeah.
I didn't know he was still alive. I was looking up. I was like, oh, I thought this guy
Elroy
passed away. Yeah.
Oh no. He's still going. I mean, he said out loud he doesn't know if he's going to be able to live to the end of the second quartet, the you know infamy Perfida quartet, but we'll see how it goes. He's pretty tough.
Fingers crossed, I guess. I wanted to get off right on the beginning. I wanted to kind of let you introduce your new book that's going to be coming out here soon.
Oh, yeah. Well, I just got back. My publisher's Punctum Books, and I just got back news from them that they just finished the typesetting. I'm going to get the final proofs this weekend and go over those. And the title of the book is The View from Howard's Fuck Pad, Bad White Men, The Deep State, Bad White Men, and The Weird Noir of James Elroy. So it's an encyclopedia exegesis, critical commentary, multidisciplinary approach, all over the place, scattershot sort of thing, discussing James Elroy's works and life. He is like, you know, certain writers like Celine or James Baldwin, he's very much a writer who writes, basically everything he writes is about himself disguised. Sometimes it's more transparent, sometimes it's a bit more opaque and occluded, but basically he's always talking about himself, or the women he's with, or the guys he used to hang out with, or something like, or the drugs he used to take, or all the women's underwear he used to sniff. He's always going on about that sort of stuff one way or another. So they're really all about him all the time. So I just delved in and I just started cutting and pasting and slicing and dissecting and deconstructing and rearranging and doing surrealist collage and torture porn to some of the outlying limbs of his literary corpus. And that's what I came up with. And I just heard news that the thing is so damn long, they've cut it into two volumes. So people will actually have to buy two books if they actually want to read mine.
So they're going to have two titles in their house that are going to be...
No. The View from Howard's Fuck Pad cannot be improved upon. So the main title is staying the same, but I had to suggest some alternative titles. I don't know if they've gone with these. I mean, they're pretty safe. Volume one, I propose, should be subtitled The Noumena of Wonder. And volume two should be The Absurdity of Whiteness.
The Absurdity of Whiteness?
The Absurdity of Whiteness.
Explain.
Well, basically, when Kamala Harris overthrows the Constitution because Donald Trump wins the election, licitly or illicitly, you know, depending on which side of history you're on, right? Then shit's really going to hit the fan. And I'm just trying to get on everybody's good side before that happens, just so they'll leave me the hell alone and I can
just don't ban my book.
I can mentally masturbate over anything I actually want to.
You're terrible.
Yeah,
you're
just
terrible.
I'm just sitting in my attic abode here, just working on my stuff, hammering it out, sometimes fast, sometimes slow. Oh, I got another book out of this. Another book's already come out in print.
It's on the back burner, right?
Well, no. It's come out. It beat Punctum the Press. Springer Nature got my other book done. It's posted electronically online on the Springer website, Springer Nature website. The hard copy will be out on May 17th. It's 665 pages and $223, so it's a real steal. And in hardback, and the title is René Girard, Law, Literature, and Cinema, The Legal Drama of the Scapegoat. And basically, these are the compilations about my lecture note on the course I used to teach at Monash University, where I was a full-time academic for about 20 years before I had to take early retirement, which is all about law, literature, and cinema. You know, rep law in literature, meaning discussions of legal issues within literary form, like Charles Dickens' Bleak House, for example, or Kafka's, of course, The Trial, or Camus' The Stranger, L'Etranger, and also law as literature, which is basically how legal texts and documents, especially pleadings and oral arguments, are really structured along narrative and literary patterns. And the only thing that I add to the long literature scholarship is that the entire book is premised upon the pretty systematic and rigorous application of Girardian methodology, which is basically that, basically I've got two premises, that the cultural character of the falsely accused, you know, the innocent man who's in the dock, right? Who may have been O.J. Simpson, but that will never
oh,
be.
Oh, God, that was my dream guest, and he's
never,
gone.
Never,
I can't believe
never
it.
Never be completely determined because, shall we say, the messengers were unreliable.
Did you see what his family deleted the tweet he put up 45 minutes? It was only up for 45 minutes. I have a screenshot of it. He said, I did. Let me read it. Let me read it 100%. Because everyone screenshotted it, because there's people that follow OJ. I wanted to speak to OJ for the past 5 years. I've reached out to him at least 3 times a year. I don't want to talk about the murder. I specifically didn't look into it. All I wanted to talk about was Naked Gun, because we're going to lose a whole chunk of history. I just want to know, did he have to audition, or did they just give him the part because he was so famous?
I think they gave him the part, but I'm not sure.
I know. So that's why I wanted to get a definitive on that. And then I was going to re-edit it and go back into it. And every time I asked him a question that wasn't about the murder or anything, I was going to add in me going, did you do it? And just have him ignoring it the whole time. So then people would be like, why isn't he answering the question? But the screenshotted clip is, hang on, I got it right here. Yeah, so he said O.J. Simpson's final tweet before dying, and these people screenshotted it. It said, O.J. Simpson, I just want y'all to know I did that shit. And then it says O.J. And it was only up for 45 minutes. And it was from his account. So I was like, yo, if that's like Norm MacDonald not telling anybody he has cancer and just dies in a shack somewhere.
Yeah.
Why'd you bring that up? You threw me off.
If we're talking about Simpson, okay, if we're talking about Simpson at all, here's my position, because students in class used to ask me about it sometimes. This is in Australia, so they didn't understand the LA thing or the Watts background, which of course was the whole, and the Rodney King beating, which of course were the two immediate background context to this situation, the Simpson trial, is that I would say that on balance, the prosecution presented not just a poor argument, but an objectively flawed one. Forensics were dodgy, witness testimony was dodgy, a lot of stuff was dodgy. And there was some very weird peccadilloes that the LAPD does seem to have committed. There were some very strange things going on. And I basically said this to people. I said, look, the bottom line is whoever did what to whom, and however strongly you feel about one way or the other, there's one right legal answer. If the accused is guilty, but the state has violated the law in the process of proving his or her guilt, what is the correct legal verdict? And the correct legal verdict is innocence. Because what's more important than convicting guilty people is holding the state unconditionally liable for breaches of the rule of law and due process. Rule of law and due process are the higher goods, even than criminal guilt or gross immorality. That is really what matters the most. And the prosecution blew the case. That is my take. Anyone doesn't agree with that? That's fine.
Well, let's take an examination on something I know more about, the court case opinion. But if we take if there would be a trial for Lee Harvey Oswald, I mean, do you think that would have been something that would have been looked at innocently or just by the law standards? Or do you think that was already kind of subdued onto what the outcome was going to be?
I simply think that there was, let me go this way, it would be a question of getting a fair trial. It would have been impossible. There is no way, even, again, this is what I've always talked about, I mean, going back to like false flags and JFK and things like that. Even if Oswald did it, he actually did the shooting. And again, it's like Simpson. Like, I know people who will start screaming at you if you even suggest as a possibility that Oswald really did the shooting, right? And I said, that's not the point. The point is, even if Oswald did the shooting, that does not exclude the fact that there was a conspiracy, right? Conspiracy is simply of two people at the absolute minimum. And a conspiracy is simply two or more people deliberately and intentionally engaging in an activity with, you know, a forethought and intent to commit a criminal act. You know, everyone talks about conspiracy theorists, blah, 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 maniacs, blah, 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 you know, basically, you know, narcissistic mama boys who never got over their shit, blah, 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 stuff like that. Well, here's something. Organized crime is institutionalized conspiracy theory. Because every act that the mafia commits is conspiratorial in some dimension, right? I mean, and when you break it down to the real nuts and bolts of crime and deviance and transgression, and not, you know, James Bond, one world government secret headquarters type crap, you know, then of course it's bleedingly obvious that conspiracies govern a huge part of criminal, legal, economic, political activity and actions. So that's the thing about that. But anyway, just going back to Simpson, for example, like I said, if you have serious doubt about the truthfulness of the prosecution's case, you have to find in favor of the defendant. And I will simply throw that out there as an abstract principle. My only take is that I believe the Simpson case fell within those guidelines. I believe there was enough to be seriously concerned about. That at the very least, a mistrial should have, I think in some ways a mistrial would have been a better verdict than innocence. But I really do feel that that jury at that time, on the basis of what they heard and knew and were told and instructed and guided by the judge, Judge Ito, who wasn't the greatest judge in the universe by any means, or even LA County for that matter, which is saying a lot, probably came up with the legally correct verdict. I don't mean the factually right verdict. I don't mean the morally right verdict. I mean the legally correct verdict.
I was going to let you go if you got more.
No, that's basically it. I mean, that's really what I say. So did he do it or not? I don't know. Some of it is absolutely damning and overwhelming. Some things I think there's legitimate questions about. And another thing that comes up as well, and this is back to Oswald, right? Even if he was the sole shooter, are we absolutely certain that no one else was involved with him in some sort of controlling capacity at some point in the sequence leading up to Dealey Plaza, right? Like George Morrison showed, this is an extremely suspicious and interesting guy, right? Same thing with Simpson. There is some evidence, it's soft and it's weak, but there's some evidence to indicate that there may have been a second party present. There may have been four people there in front of the condo, not just three.
Well, isn't if there's anything that would be suspicious or have a slight bit of evidence that would change the official narrative or conclusion, if you would normally investigate that, that would be doing a critical thinking aspect to things rather than what has somehow been labeled today, which is conspiracy thinking. If we stick along the lines of JFK, we don't need to talk about OJ, but if we stick along the lines with JFK and we look at Lee Harvey Oswald, there's a lot more than just Lee Harvey Oswald did it alone, but somehow that term conspiracy, you mentioned a real example, which is organized crime, but people don't want to relate that to the state. A lot of people aren't too informed on what organized crime actually their influence was, besides the popular mobsters like John Dillinger, Jimmy Hoffa, and others.
When I edited my first book, which is Government of the Shadows, which was published by Pluto Press in 2008, and that's actually a fairly famous book. I actually edited two landmark books, Government of the Shadows with Pluto Press and National Security Complex with Ashgate. And in both those volumes that I edited, Olanda Tunander contributed a chapter. He was at the conference we had in Melbourne, and I didn't have a conference for the second book on the National Security Complex, but he contributed a chapter. And in those are the two things he's written that actually threw out and established the current usage and understanding of the term deep state. Okay. And at the Melbourne conference, I had a discussion with a very important and prominent Italian criminologist. And of course, when you're talking to an Italian criminologist, you are talking about only three things, what, right? P2, the P2 Masonic Lodge problem, right? The Vatican, which is like a cosmic problem. And then three, the Mafia, right? Italian, Neapolitan, Calabrian, Apulian, Bolognese, doesn't matter which one, or Roman even. Yeah, even, of course, the Roman Mafia is a joke. But anyway, that's what you're talking about, right? And so, and he kept on saying, "I'm not a mafiologist, damn it." Right. So anyway, I got talking to Vincenzo a lot and about this, and I mentioned to him, I said, "So I guess really what I'd like to do is have someone at the conference. I mean, I guess you'd be the point man on this one, to talk about how the mafia infiltrated and subverted the southern Italian state, leading and going straight up the coast away to Rome." And he says, "Well, that's fine, but you've got it backwards. The mafia did not penetrate and subvert the Italian state. The Italian state penetrated and subverted the mafia." In other words, what the Italian state did, quite rightly, and I was really caught out, and he was completely right, and I've changed my attitude about Italian criminal, about Italian criminogenic structures and asymmetries 180 degrees, is that the Italian state, especially the Christian Democratic Party, the conservative national party after World War II, the one of the Americans favored, and the Americans stole a whole bunch of elections and the communists won just to keep the Christian Democrats in, was that they were using them as proxies to keep the Sicilian and Calabrian peasants in line to either not vote communist or make sure that the local ballot boxes were tampered with. Right, the CDU couldn't do it openly, so they did it illicitly. And their middlemen were engaging in political crimes in southern Italy were the Amici di Amici, the friends of the friends. And in Italy, it all makes sense, because in Italy, everyone's Famiglia. Everyone's connected to a Famiglia. Everyone's a friend to somebody, right? Even if they're not a blood relation. Now, that's the interesting thing about Roman history. Blood relations counted much, much less. Far less than political or social connections, right? Which is one reason why adopted children were often the preferred heirs to large estates, because the estate owner, the paterfamilias guy, actually liked the adopted children much more than his own. And it was like standard practice. There was nothing unusual about the famiglia trumping the family, the biological unit, the kinship unit. So when you've got that kind of social structure in which everyone is doing favors for everybody all the time, because that's how life works. So you've sort of got this kind of much later modern bureaucratic administrative state that's sort of emerging goo-like out of this much wider and far more deeply entrenched social network totality of connections and relationships. You don't have the necessary cultural preconditions for the Anglo-Western ideal model of the autonomous, independent, objective, neutral, and arbiter state. Everything is a connection. Everything is a vested interest. Everything is a partisan cause. Everything is particularism before the game even starts. Right. So therefore, appropriating the machinery and pulling the levers until you get the result that you want is standard practice.
Well, it's like if you examine United States operations, people want a conclusion of like the army did this or the military did this. They want to see that straight one-to-one connection. But that's not how these like intelligence agencies work. They either use cutouts, they use other various things where their names don't trace back. Even a good example, which is Monsanto's, that horrible chemical company over here, Coca-Cola. That's their partnership with that company. On Monsanto's website, it says in 1907, our whole product and our whole line would be nothing without the use of the company Coca-Cola. And they also, it's the reason why all these army vets during the Vietnam War loved drinking Coke and they called themselves a Coke family, is because that Coke sponsored not the Vietnam War, but they were donating Cokes to troops. And also Agent Orange was one of the chemicals produced by Monsanto's. There's a connection there with that company and with Coca-Cola. But people want to see the exact Coca-Cola said they sponsored this. And I'm like, well, you're never going to get that. And especially with the United States operations, you're not going to get the mob was contacted by the United States government. You're going to get a person was a middleman that connected the United States and also connected these mob organizations.
And these middlemen are often like what we would call civilians, right? They're private persons engaging in this activity for a personal agenda or a personal motive. And remember, I think the whole problem is kind of summarized by the Noam Chomsky problem, but the Noam Chomsky syndrome.
He's a bit of a problem.
Well, yeah, he will live forever, apparently. But he always said that he excluded the possibility of an assassination, I mean, an organized conspiratorial assassination of JFK, organized by the deep state. He said, because there'd be no reason to do so. He said that no U.S. president ever deviates from the line of the mandarins, you know, the entrenched bureaucracies, in a significant enough manner, in an extreme enough degree to warrant executive action, right? You know, he has backed down on his rather monolithic approach to U.S. foreign policy. He says, sure, look, there are dissenters, there are conflicts of opinions, but if you apply hegemony theory, usually the predictable outcome will be pretty much like what you're going to get at the end of the day, right? Like, for example, we know, again, whatever your own preferences are, whatever your own background is, we knew that the United States was going to back Israel virtually to the hilt, practically no matter what, because the geopolitical and geostrategic advantages of having Israel as a junior partner in the Middle East are simply too valuable to risk. Maybe using a nuclear weapon on Rafah, I don't know, but I cannot think of any scenario that would seriously raise the possibility, create the conditions of an objective breach between the United States and Israel. And everybody knows that. Everybody in the Middle East knows that Israel is the 51st state, or maybe I should say the 52nd state after the UK, right? Everyone knows that Israel is the 52nd state of the United States. Geostrategically and geopolitically, that is how it works, right? So nothing, you know, we know all this. But the thing about the Chomsky take on JFK, and when I actually started going into it in much more detail than I ever knew before for my book, Spectacle of the False Flag, which is the first book I published with Punctum, is that, and of course, by the way, I even got a jump on Elroy. Elroy's absolute favorite novel is Libra by Don DeLillo. And he says he basically, Elroy, he's a little bit like Stephen King. He really loves taking down the canonical novelists, you know, like Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and all those guys, because he said, I don't think they're so shit hot, right? But Don DeLillo, he worships, and he says there are some things you don't fuck around with, and Don DeLillo's Libra is one of them. He says, so once I read it, I said, I can't write my JFK novel, so I had to come up with something completely different, and he wrote Underground USA. Underworld USA, right, which is the first part of the Underworld USA trilogy, and which is his take on Dallas and the JFK assassination. And so I read Libra, before I started working my book on Sexual False Flag, I just read Libra, and I was just totally blown away from it. And I said, if there was anything there in the sense that we mean by conspiracy, right, he's probably got it in its essence, in, you know, maybe not, obviously not in the details. The details will never be figured out if there was something there in the first place at all, okay? But he certainly got the spirit of the thing right. And when I started moving from DeLillo to you know, various sources like Larry Hancock and a bunch of other guys who did really, really good research in this area, you begin finding what you call, that famous phrase from the movie Casablanca, the usual suspects. You start coming across a bunch of characters who you actually start believing could have gotten the idea in their head to whack JFK around sometime after the Cuban Missile Crisis at the very latest, right? And these guys, and I think of all of the usual suspects, CIA, FBI, military intelligence, mafia, Jimmy Hoffa, all the standard usual suspect Cubans, which are a bit more interesting and persuasive personally for me anyway. The one group that I think is absolutely vital, first of all, they're just important to understand anyway, given all the black bag operations that are going on in the Mediterranean, and pardon me, the Mediterranean, the Caribbean, well, actually the Caribbean too, pardon me, the Mediterranean too, if you include the Sicilian connection and the French connection running out of Marseille. And all the drugs coming in, narcotics coming in from Turkey. All the black bag operations or the murder incorporated that LBJ was complaining about, that JFK got set up in the Caribbean, are the American mercenaries and paramilitaries. And here you have guys who were ex-army, or ex-military intelligence, but now operating in a so-called private capacity. So it gives the state absolute and total plausible denial, right? That's not us. That's somebody else. That's them. We never ordered that. They went, they're doing this thing on their own, working with criminals like Jimmy Hoffa or Meyer Lansky or Santos Traficante, right? And they were well connected enough. And honestly, they were just psychotic enough. You've what you've got in JFK, and you've got in the whole setup at the University of Miami, which was at the time the world's biggest CIA complex during the early 60s.
How'd you know that, though?
How'd I know what?
Because I like looking at college campuses and trying to see the influence of the CIA on there.
JM Wave. I mean, what we got, okay. We got some of the budget appropriations. Those have been released. And the money being spent there was greater than anything else. So it was the primary focus of at least in terms of the Western Hemisphere, it was the primary package that the CIA was involved with for the Kennedy period, Kennedy years. And JM Wave. What you've got is a bunch of people who aren't really part of the government in any conventional sense being interjected into all these middlemen roles between Cubans, anti-Castro and pro-Castro, between informants and FBI, between weapon and gun smuggling operations and anti-Castro propaganda organizations and activities, right? What you've got is you've got this whole slew or slewage of private actors who have now been essentially deputized by the American government to do a whole ton of off the books black bag operations, partly for everyone to be sacrificed on the altar of plausible denial. You don't have configurations like that very often. And when you do, it's a disaster. Another example, I don't know if it was quite as much cloak and dagger as it was in the Caribbean during the anti-Castro, the golden age of the anti-Castro operations. But remember the lead up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003? The third Gulf War?
I would have been probably 6 years old, so...
Yeah, but not. I mean, you do read, and you spend a lot of time on the internet, I know that, so...
No, I don't.
Okay. It just seems that you do, because I always seem to be talking to you on the internet.
Give me your phone number, I'll be calling you up.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you don't want to give me your phone number.
I'll give
you
my phone number in hell, how's that? Okay, look, so...
With OJ. FaceTime him for me.
Hey, man, you know, I don't presume to judge, right? I just look at the evidence and figure out if somebody screwed up or not, but which the prosecution did, but that's just an aside.
Apparently the glove didn't fit, so.
Well, yeah. Okay. Anyway. Okay, I lost my train of thought.
I know. It happens more often than you think.
Right. The lead up to 2003, the invasion of Iraq, or what we sometimes call the third Gulf War, right? First Gulf War was between Iran and Iraq. Second Gulf War was 1991 when George Bush was going to be president forever, and it didn't work that way because it was the economy, stupid. And then 2003 when George Bush Jr. decided to settle all family business.
Dodge two shoes in the process.
Yeah. What the real debate to the lead up of the actual attack, which by the way, was grossly illegal under unlawful under international law. What the lead up to the attack was, what the big debate was, what was the talking issue? What was the point issue? What was the talking point? What was the pointed talking point issue that everybody was going on about nonstop? The big lead up. Do you remember what that was?
Weapons of mass destruction.
WMDs. Oh yeah, he's got him. Remember when Colin Powell destroyed himself? The history, the future of the history of the human race, collective memory thereof forever, by saying that a balloon inflation machine was like a site of manufacturing poisonous gas. Remember all that stuff? Where did all that so-called intelligence come from? It came from a bunch of Iraqi defectors who were on the pay of either MI6 or Mossad. The British and the Israelis massaged the evidence through their paid hirelings to present the media with all kinds of leaks about WMDs. Right. And then once you get these private actors involved in the chain of propaganda campaigns and the cherry picking of military intelligence, then you've got their own motives that are coming into play that their handlers may not even be aware of completely. Right. And of course, as we know, it's a fantastic mess because, among other things, we now know with absolute and total certainty. And by the way, I was the only one saying this that I knew. I mean, in Australia, I think I was the only guy saying Iraq does not have WMDs. Oh, yeah, right, sure, right, fine, yeah. And guess what? I was right. Okay. And anyone with half a brain knew they didn't have them. And you know why? Because if he had them, Saddam Hussein knew that he would have been destroyed immediately. He had every incentive not to have them at this point, right? But why did he never completely, unconditionally clear everything? First of all, UN inspectors did not have the right to go into his private residences or check out the palaces because those are aspects of national sovereignty. But more importantly, he didn't want to let anyone know among his own people or the Iranians that he didn't have WMDs. He had to keep them guessing just in case they get ideas. Right? Because we do know he actually had used toxin gases against rebel groups within his own country. So we know he was capable of using them, at least weaker ones on a smaller, more local scale. Right? It's the same thing about the Israelis. You know, they always play smart with how many nuclear weapons does Israel have? Not affirm, not deny, right? And everybody knows that at a minimum, they've got 90. The highest estimate I've ever heard that's reliable was up to 300.
Well, it's self-preservation, isn't it? When you're bragging like that, just so other countries don't invade you, you look a lot tougher than you are.
That's right. But what I'm just saying is that anyone who thought about it clinically would have come to that conclusion themselves. I did. I know other people did. But the trouble is we were getting force-fed this bullshit stuff that was coming from people who were receiving huge paychecks and promises for forming part of the future Iraqi government to just invent these fantasies about WMDs. Right. But the important point is not simply the government's lie. There's no news to that. The news flash, though, may be that we underestimate the degree to which these kind of operations are being motivated by purely personal motives and objectives.
Well, if we took something that a lot more people have probably examined closely than maybe studying the Iraq War, at least amongst the general population, everyone's heard of it. And I think it's probably had for the past 60 years some of the most closest examinations that bring up all those connections we were mentioning earlier. The JFK assassination. How come people don't want to get to the point on that? It's a topic they don't want to touch, a lot of people. But then if we examine the connections like you mentioned the Cuban side. I'd love to hear your opinion on that. But the LBJ did it crowd, the mafia did it crowd, the military industrial complex. There's so much, but there's not a definitive.
Yeah, the Oliver Stoneites. Yeah.
I'm a military industrial guy, did it?
Yeah. Sure. So the question is what exactly?
The question is with something like the JFK assassination that has such a close examination, how come with all these different connections to different plot points, people won't even give it the time of day than other than Lee Harvey Oswald did it?
Yeah, I know. It's a little bit of a cultural schizophrenia because on the one hand, I think it was the New York Times, maybe it was the Washington Post, did a survey a couple years ago, I think maybe 10 years ago, and just asking about people's opinion about the Kennedy assassination. And the absolute majority of people, I don't know what the demographic breakdown was of the doubters and the resistors, but the absolute majority of respondents, well over 50%, said they do not believe the totality of the Warren Report. In other words, they believe there's something wrong with the Warren Report. You believe there's something wrong with the prosecution evidence on some level, in some ways, at the JFK case.
But you just don't know where.
OJ case. Yeah. Well, Barry Rosen really did a great job. Okay, but that's for law school stuff, not real world stuff, right?
When you examine the Kennedy assassination, all the connections in it.
And the connections, right. And you look at the stuff about general skepticism about the Warren Report. No, people aren't necessarily saying that there was a conspiracy. The general consensus seems to believe there's a lot of stuff that probably happened that they didn't tell us about. it's like a black box, right? You know there's a black box, and you know there's something in the black box, but you don't know what it is or what it does, right? That seems to be the general consensus. Now, but when you move past that into making reasonably intelligent, fairly well-educated guesses about what might be in that black box, you run up into kind of an epistemic problem, because you know there's something there, but have you got enough to actually work with to come up with a fairly compelling account of what that thing probably is? Right? And there's, like I said, so, with so much of conspiracy theory, and which is why it's such a dodgy, touchy, touch-and-go sort of thing. Sometimes it's done better. Most of the time it's done much worse. But you've got an epistemic gap. Once you start going into the details of the thing that might be in the black box, what's its color? How many limbs does it got? Does it have two heads? How many eyes? What does it eat? Right? You start coming into problems. There are so many things you cannot exclude. Is there any limit to the number of things that you can include? Right. And, you know, Robert Anton Wilson and the Illuminati trilogy was the thing I was thinking about the last time that we talked. I forgot the name of the trilogy, but at the Illuminati trilogy, Robert Anton Wilson literally puts everybody in the world at Dealey Plaza on November 22. He does. The Vatican's there. The UN's there. Mother Teresa's there. Everybody's there. Okay. Because as he's established perfectly well, and knows perfectly well, because he likes these kind of logical conundrums. Once you say there was an organized conspiracy of some kind, how do you know in advance, a priori, who was not involved? And then when you enter in the factor about all we're talking about, the connections, right? The Famiglia versus Familia. Where do you draw the limits? You know, is Rip Robertson one of the scariest guys I ever read about in my entire life? One of the supreme paramilitary mercenaries operating in the Caribbean.
My great uncle.
Right. Who, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Who do you know with certainty he knew or did not know?
I don't know much about him. So.
And those who knew him, who do they know or not know?
What'd you learn about him? I'm curious now.
Oh, basically, yeah, you go through, there's several good books. And I even think Jim Garrison mentions him in passing in On the Trail of Assassins. But if you go into any of the more encyclopedia works, like some of the stuff Larry Hancock's come up with, for example, you will come across Rip Robertson. Okay, so yeah, but a guy like that, when I read about Rip and a couple of the other guys, and whom DeLillo is clearly referencing and modeling some of his characters on, in Libra, like Grayston Lynch, for example. You say to yourself, well, Noam Chomsky notwithstanding, excuse me, who could have gotten up, gone out and done something like this? And my answer is guys like Rip Robertson, right?
Guys like Howard Hunt and others?
Yeah. Yeah, and because they're in the government, but at the same, but even more the paramilitaries and citizen groups like the Minutemen, for example, who were huge in the Cuban gun smuggling and partisan paramilitary training programs out in Lake Pontchartrain in Louisiana. These are the guys who, in other words, they were liminal. They were transitional characters. They were on the border. They were inside and outside simultaneously.
Perfect example would be William Harvey, who was part of the getting the Cuban military troops, resistance fighters.
He was, but Harvey obviously would have been a prime suspect. I think when I wrote,
they're too built up for me though. Like even learning
when I was writing Spectacle of the False Flag, I my whole approach in Spectacle of the False Flag, really, Spectacle of the False Flag is about Guy Debord. And situationism. That's what the book's really about. And De Boer made the point, he said, if we live in a society of the spectacle, then conspiratorialism and conspiracism will be necessary as attributes of such a cultural system because of the following. And I give all the reasons why that is the case. And I find his reasoning pretty persuasive. Okay. So what I'm going to say is, as a criminologist investigating trying to come up with a way of making Guy Debord and the Society of the Spectacle applicable to criminological research and analysis, I said to myself, well, let's go with conspiracy theories. You know, let's see if I can find a way to make them work. Or more to the point, take some classic arguable conspiracy theory scenarios like JFK, like Watergate, like the Gulf of Tonkin, right? I just restricted myself to those three because they're all more or less within the same time period, right? And involve many of the same characters, right? Like Howard Hunt. And say, I'll do a Deboring analysis. Let me read these as criminological manifestations of the Society of the Spectacle. And of course, everyone misread the book as saying, oh, well, you think there was a Kennedy. So this is your explanation of the Kennedy assassination. I said, no, this is not my explanation of the Kennedy assassination. What I'm saying is, if Guy Debord wrote a book about JFK, this is the book he would have written. That's what I wrote, right? Or that's what I intended to write. And I think I more or less did that. And so at one point, partly to keep the readership and my publishers happy, I sort of came up with a short list of the usual suspects. And I went through the whole list. If we can figure it this way, we've got this paradigm. If we can figure it that way, we've got this paradigm. In paradigm A, mafioso are at the top and CIA guys are at the middle. In paradigm B, it's all CIA and the mafia guys are a bunch of jokes standing around jerking off in the toilet. I mean, you know, you can arrange the players and the cards in lots and lots of different ways. But Harvey always came up fairly high in my paradigms, applying the principles, the Deborian principles of Society of the Spectacle, but not the highest. To me, the real hot tickets are the anti-Castro Cuban community itself, many of whom are actually double agents and privately paid informants for both sides simultaneously. So double and triple agents all over the place. And I think the American paramilitaries and mercenaries, because they would have fit all the necessary criteria from a Deborian perspective, right? And a parapolitical perspective of liminality and being both of and not of the state simultaneously. And they can hijack and appropriate and use for their own purposes more what we would call official or formal government apparatus and resources for really what are personal or private ends. And when we talk about parapolitics in particular, that's really what it means. The best definition of parapolitics, short definition, was Robert Cribb, who also contributed to the book Spectacle of the False Flag. And what he said, what parapolitics really is the privatization of state clandestine and covert capacities. And that's where the breakdown between crime and law takes place. Because you have legal officers, formal officers of the state, acting in a private manner for private objectives, and you have private actors acting as servants of the state.
Then which one would be in the wrong, though, if you have private actors working in the service of the state?
Private actors working in the service of the state, meaning that you don't really give Johnny Rosselli a military uniform and a commission in military intelligence with a rank of major.
But you're more than happy to keep him with private information and information that you wouldn't want released out to the general public.
Sure. If you simply tapped him as an informant pursuant to, let's say, an FBI operation, that by itself is not problematic, although complications can arise.
Could we consider him an informant?
Let me put it this way. If you want to talk to Fidel Castro and you send Santo Traficante as your messenger, is at that moment, is Traficante a member, an agent, a representative of the U.S. state or not?
Well, he's your king and you're moving him forward to get attacked.
So what is that? How do you classify that? And this is what part of the problem is. It's our language. It's our etymology. It's our terminology. It's our taxonomies. How do we actually classify stuff like this? But yet, at the same time, if we don't take it into account, if we do not appreciate it, if we do not understand how important this stuff is, how many wheels turn because of this parapolitical lubrication, then you won't understand history. Oh, let me put it this way. You got no chance of understanding history.
Well, you're asking, especially if you look at the general public, you'd be asking people to understand definitions that aren't commonly used phrases. I mean, if you study military operations, you'd know about the words like, I think everyone knows what propaganda is, but things like psyops, operations like false flags or white ops, black ops, people don't know what these words are and how they get implemented. But it seems like if you really examine what those definitions are, you can point at clear-cut examples throughout the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. I mean, the way that we distorted our view entirely of putting each other on different sides of the who did it crowd, and also the amount of information that are real clear connections, not necessarily to the assassination itself, but just clear political corruption. But we can't even have the discussion about corruption in our when we talk about our state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and partly, and I think, and of course, the contrast with Italy.
I think the S-Force is a psyop, to be 100% honest with you. I think it's so perfect that you would choose that. I mean, it's a good example. There's a lot of evidence to support the S-Force and the whole Nixon backing that and the Watergate plumbers and it's all this deep connection that goes there. But there's a lot of things that don't make sense. Now, S-Force was the Cuban exile groups that were mixed in with names like David Attlee Phillips and Howard Hunt and all those.
Right, absolutely. No, absolutely. You're 100% right about that. I talked about it but in a different from a different angle, but you know, that's absolutely true. That arrangement, that complex, that is and is not of the state at the same time, is both literally unnameable and yet is so omnipresent. I mean, it slithers around. You can trace its tentacles, use a Cthulhu metaphor, you can trace its tentacles into almost, you know, back to, from almost any major Cuban or anti-Cuban event in the early 60s, you can trace it back to that thing. S4. It's just, you know, it is so ubiquitous that its sheer ubiquity starts becoming suspicious in and of itself.
Well, it's a really smart strategy of a United States government, if you do believe the military-industrial complex was behind the trigger of it, that if you just somehow dipped some of your really top-secret covert operations involved in one giant event that necessarily just had a small part to play, like using the same people you've used in separate operations, those files will remain locked and not fall under a JFK Act or something of
and
that
there won't
sort.
Even, there won't even be a lot of files either. A lot of time they make sure that it stays completely off the books. It's irretrievable. You can't get it back.
Agreed. But can you maybe explain, like, if I don't know if you've examined it enough to be able to look at the psyops that were involved in the Kennedy assassination? Not necessarily how we view it and talk about it now, but just the massive amount of confusion that really kind of start. It'll make your head explode when you first go into it.
Yeah, it did. And but then you realize that the whole thing makes a great deal more sense if you understand what the S-Force people, especially David Attlee Phillips, did in Guatemala several years before JFK.
What, run a newspaper organization?
No. It was the overthrow of the Guatemalan government. And what they did, it was basically military intelligence run by David Attlee Phillips, then at the CIA, using military communication technology to simulate an advancing rebel army advancing on the capital. There was no army, but they simulated the radio transmissions of an army. And of course, everyone in the Guatemalan government panicked because they thought there was going to be an uprising. And there really was not one in place. There was a lot of opposition, but that was just more or less popular in the streets. It wasn't at all well organized. But they actually managed to simulate a phantom rebel army advancing on the capital and causing the president to flee into exile. And around the time of JFK, you have all these weird events like you're talking about defectors showing up who appear out of nowhere. Somewhat, not at all unlike some of the people who were talking about WMDs just prior before the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Planes showing up that claimed that they were being shot at by the Cuban Air Force. And this happened for several weeks after Oswald's death. Strange letters showing up for him, showing up from Cuba, that seemed to be in code of some kind. And you get the sense, I mean, what the impression that you get is that they obviously had this scenario of him being fingered as a Cuban agent, which, if, and again, if it was a false flag, that would be absolutely vital. You would have to establish a connection between him and Cuba at the very least for it to constitute a false flag killing.
Well, they already had him with the whole New Orleans
They wanted even more than that. I mean, he's in active control at that moment in time.
They could have got a photo of him and Castro eating an ice cream together. Would have really solidified him.
Yeah, well, after the Joe Biden thing, I don't think I'll ever feel like eating an ice cream in public ever again.
Oh, anyway, come on.
Especially while plotting genocide. But
I know.
In my mind, anyway.
Ice cream makes you hungry.
Yeah.
Or genocide makes you hungry.
Well, for certain things. These letters, a lot of the stuff around the Oswald and the Cuban stuff immediately afterwards does seem to be something that a machine was set in motion to get this stuff out to bolster the story that was already in place that he was a Cuban agent. Right. And that, of course, is what LBJ and I think Hoover basically shut down, precisely because they probably suspected either that Castro did do it and they didn't want to risk World War III, right? Or they suspected it was a false flag and someone, some private or semi-private or public or semi-public agency within the United States, organization of the United States, was trying to draw the Americans into an invasion of Cuba, and they wanted to short-circuit the whole deal. So, like I said, and I kind of agree with both DeLillo and also David Kaiser as well, who's, I think, I don't want to besmirch Professor Kaiser, but I think his academic career was pretty much destroyed.
He's been on the show twice, so.
Well, I know, but they kicked him down in the basement at the in the history faculty, gave him a basement office. I think maybe that they've reversed themselves. I hope so. Anyway, come out and said that the only thing, and also to Peter Dale Scott as well, his last book, Dallas 63. He's come out and said this. I mean, that was Peter at his most direct. He more or less puts his cards on the table and lets you know what he really thought happened. And all these guys, DeLillo, Kaiser, and Scott, all pointed to the same thing. The only thing that really makes sense, or the thing that is the least implausible theory of a conspiracy properly, meaning conventionally understood, not just George Morenschild talking Oswald into doing it, right? Something a bit more.
See, I think the evidence on DeMorenshield doesn't necessarily fit the whole. I mean, he fits the deep state profile, but he just doesn't seem like the, because he defended Oswald. So
yeah, no. I simply use that as an example of what could have happened. I mean, it could have been DeMorenshield simply puts the idea in Oswald's head and he goes out and acts on it, right? But if so, that is technically a conspiracy. It fits the legal definition of conspiracy. But I think they all say that the least implausible explanation or theory for a conspiracy in the sense that everyone means it when they use the word conspiracy would have been as a false flag operation. A provocation to bring about some sort of major shift in U.S. military and foreign policy against either Cuba, Russia, and or Vietnam, or possibly even all three.
And a clear-cut example, one that is well-documented, yet people still doubt its belief in it. And even though we've been shown it, Operation Northwoods.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, and when, of course, the thing that makes Northwoods so ultra toxic is that you come up with that scenario about somebody flying an airplane into a major public building and blowing it up. And no one's got the cojones to touch that one.
Well, they had other ideas, too, of trying to...
Oh, no, I know, but that idea is very much there. And
well,
then,
taking down a sports team that's traveling to another country and blaming it on, like, that's pretty insane.
Of course, you know, there was a Russian soccer team that got wiped out in a plane crash. I didn't know if that had anything to do with it, but that was, like, you know, 30 years ago or so.
Yeah, that went in the mountains or something like that.
Well, no. Though, actually, I think they landed on the field. No, that was the mountains thing was something. I think it was an Argentinian or Peruvian football team. Anyway... those are the only examples I know about entire sports teams getting wiped out in midair. I think that wasn't there a high school football team that got wiped out or something in the United States a couple years ago too? Anyway, it doesn't matter. But I mean, no, the,
Can't say it doesn't matter, man. You got to say it matters.
It doesn't matter in terms of evidence for parapolitical activity.
Fair, fair point.
That's what I meant. Okay. So,
rest in peace for him.
Rest in peace.
And say you praise Donald Trump.
So what?
Just referencing an old joke that we had in our podcast a couple while back about how you have to always denounce Donald Trump.
Oh, yeah. Donald Trump's a son of a bitch. Okay.
There you go.
Nobody vote for him.
Okay. Now it's safe.
Just don't vote for him. Okay. So, yeah, do your duty to God and don't get Joe Biden back in for another 4 years.
Good God. I'll take RFK.
Well, actually, RFK is actually more I've been listening to him.
He's not crazy.
I don't know. Okay, yeah, that's yes. He's not crazy. That's the best way of summing him up. He is not crazy. Okay, I lost my train of thought again. What am I talking about?
We're talking about sports teams, operational.
Yeah, yeah. No. It's the airplane crash thing. Nobody wants to revisit the big thing. To that extent, because you are absolutely guaranteed to have your credibility destroyed.
You talking about 9/11?
I'm not telling you what it is. I'm just saying is that it's the
sound like you're talking about 9/11.
It's the thing that is twice as big as you can imagine.
Well, if you even mention,
absolutely nobody wants to talk about.
If you mention even anything about it, people immediately chunk you in the super crazy conspiracy thing,
which is where we were with Kennedy about 30 years ago. I mean, I don't think we're there anymore.
Well, I mean, it's just looking at the real clear evidence of some really weird questioning. Like, why do the families have questions that deserve answers? Nobody should challenge that. Nobody does challenge that. But then people bring up things like, oh, the families are just distraught. I was like, well, when they were doing another investigation, they decided to get rid of the scrap metal and give it to China less than a week. Like, people were screaming and articles were coming out about how that was insane. So if you try and take things back, how do we get to a point? Is it the years of propaganda? Is it the years of just psychological tricks on our minds and these ideas where we still have these notions and beliefs that not the government can't be corrupt? It has to be certain individuals. And they're usually people that don't get involved onto your political party. That's why I try not to associate with one.
That's absolutely the right. Last part is absolutely right. But partisanship aside, I'm not sure people really are convinced the government's not corrupt. I think Americans in many ways are very anti-government. And I think that political corruption in the government itself does not scandalize anyone. There can be arguments over any specific event, like did Hunter Biden really do serious shit or not, right? Or is it just a mind game the Republicans are playing? Okay, that sort of stuff. But nobody really, I think, in general, denies the possibility of a corrupt government in the United States. I think it goes back, and this is something I kind of want to talk about briefly before I go.
You're leaving me already?
Well, soon. Is that it's, well, in a while. It sort of goes back to what we were talking about Italy. And I think really it's a question of culture. I mean, it's almost an anthropological phenomenon, because when the Italian, if you walked up to people in Italy and they say, is the state owned by private interest? Everyone would say yes and not think anything about it. Because it's a Famiglia culture, right? I don't like applying organic metaphors to cultural phenomena, but there is something very organic about the Italian situation. It's just a natural flow on from the pre-existing feudal or even classical Roman systems of patronage and clientelism and cronyism, right? And that's how the empire ran. It ran on those grounds. I mean, the emperor really was never a public office. He was simply the commander-in-chief of the army, the executive. The commander-in-chief is what Caesar meant. That's what the term meant. And he simply more or less owned the title that gave him supreme command over the army. There was never a constitutional role for the emperor ever until the very end, until about after the time of Constantine, Diocletian, and Theodorus, when they actually started more or less reconstituting the imperium as a monarchy, then things became a bit clearer in terms of like constitutional authority and powers. But it was very much in many ways a private operation of something of Famiglia. Anglo-Saxons have a very different culture. And remember, the United States is all post-feudal. That's what Karl Marx said about the United States. The one great thing about the United States is that it is the world's first completely post-feudal society. And one thing you have, if you're post-feudal, if you come into existence sometime after the year 1600, what you will probably have in terms of your core political beliefs that are so core, that you don't, or you're not even consciously aware of them. It's like the oxygen you breathe, or the water that the fish swim around in. They're not even conscious of it, right? Is that there is a clear, recognizable, and enforceable distinction between public and private. That's what people don't want to give up on. No matter how corrupt the state may be, it's still something separate from and greater than purely private agency.
You believe that there's not private agencies connected into the public's domain of the, if you want to talk about the state?
Sure, of course. But of course there are. But the point is that what is acceptable speech? What can be said? What is common sense? What is the sort of thing that if you said it, you would be stigmatized as a maniac, deviant, transgressor?
Anything that would be against what the media is showing on television right now.
Right, exactly.
You talking about Israel is going to get me in some shit.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I can't monetize the first 5 minutes of this podcast because you said the F word already in the first 5 minutes.
Oh yeah, fuck that.
Yeah, I can't. It's a good word. I don't care about monetization on that one. That's a good one.
Okay.
But yeah, Israel, people don't like what side you're on. And nobody wants to talk about the fact that I have friends that are Palestinian, and they ask you to choose a side. What about the American racism they had long before this thing even happened? Now they're wanting you to be on their side about it. And it's just kind of like, I don't know where we get, if you even say that, people go and they label you something. I'm like, well, they're real things and experiences.
Okay, well, here's the dichotomy then. And
don't
I
mess with the Zohan called it in 2014. That whole movie was about the Palestinian and Israel conflict.
Oh, yeah. No, it's not that. It's just that, let me put it this way. One of the things that the left uses to demonize Donald Trump and Donald Trump supporters is that they are conspiracy theorists, right? They believe in conspiracy theories like COVID, for example, or their conspiracy theory.
Can't say that.
Take on COVID. I'm saying that their take on it, no judgment or evaluation whatsoever as to its legitimacy or credibility. Merely, we're talking about public discourse and speech, nothing else. Okay. So one of the things that Trump supporters, the MAGA supporters, the red baseball cap wearing people are always being stigmatized for is being conspiracy theorists, right? But at the same time, what did Hillary Clinton do on the day after the election that she lost? Russian interference. Well, if Donald Trump won and Hillary lost because of Russian interference, does not such a statement meet all the criteria of a conspiracy theory? Structurally, formally. Again, no, I have no opinion whatsoever as to what the Russians did or did not do, and if they did anything, what effect it actually had. No opinion whatsoever. Zero. I'm talking about public speech, representation in the media. Is what she said a conspiracy theory? Does it meet the criteria of a conspiracy theory? Yes, it does. So, therefore, the question then becomes, are we talking about people who are for conspiracy, believe in conspiracy theories, and the people who don't believe in conspiracy theories, meaning someone is insane and somebody else is a bunch of suckers? Or are we really in the domain of competing conspiracy theories? So, right. Okay. So we're not talking about the objective truth of the contending sides in competing conspiracy theories. We're talking about the public speech and the politics of the public speech. So therefore, are we really in an era in which it's pro-conspiracy theory versus anti-conspiracy theory, or is it really contending conspiracy theories, right? You can say that Donald Trump won the election in 2016 because of Russian interference, which meets the formal criteria of a conspiracy theory, but it seems to be okay to say that, not because it's true or false, and again, I have no opinion as to whether it's true or false, but because it's a way of signifying your political allegiance.
True.
Right? And therefore, if you believe in a conspiracy that's associated with the right wing or the MAGA, and it could be COVID or it could be something else, why we have so many, why open borders, apparently, whether borders are open or not, businesses about BOM, businesses about social justice, whatever they are they rejected by the left and by the progressive middle because these statements are wrong, or is it because they're a rival form of a conspiracy theory? It's a bad conspiracy theory.
Well,
right? A conspiracy theory for bad people is maybe a better way of putting it.
If we examined one conspiracy theory that it gets labeled as, which I don't think it makes any sense to label it as that, which would be that election rigging, ballot stuffing, those types of things.
Yep.
That's labeled a conspiracy theory, and you can't really talk about it on YouTube. But to say that there's not any election fraud ever is so stupid to say, because of course there's interference from other countries or anything, even states that don't have some, probably politicians that have some, you know, grease the pot a little bit. But that's just because that's what we do in other countries. That's what everyone does. Everyone wants to influence the outcome for their person. It's supporting the way that they view that they can best support the patron that they want to be in charge.
Well, you know, really, if criminology is really all about crime and who does it and why does it happen and what can we do about it, I think really, at the end of the day, the explanation for any crime is that the crime happened because it could have. If you're running for office and you are in a situation in which you could get one of your supporters to stuff a ballot box and get away with it, would you do it? In other words, is not the opportunity for a crime very close to a sufficient explanation for the occurrence of that crime?
It is.
Right. So in other words, if ballot boxes can be stuffed, we know, reasoning from an axiom, right? Ballot boxes will be stuffed. We don't know how many, we don't know when, we don't know how, and we don't know what difference it'll make. I mean, there's that great line in Stone's movie Nixon, right? Nixon's complaining about losing the election, which we now know that the mafia in Chicago and LBJ's army of paralegal goons in Texas did in fact steal for Kennedy, or certainly they tilted the scales a little bit in both places. So you have Anthony Hopkins as Nixon screaming at the camera saying, "He outspent me, and he still cheated." Right? So, you know, you can stuff a ballot box and you still wind up losing, right? But all we know is that if something can be done and there's an incentive to do it, that thing will be done, whether we call it legal or illegal, lawful or criminal, right? So you're quite right. There is, if a ballot box can be stuffed, at least some ballot boxes will be stuffed. And if you break it, it's like talking about JFK. We're talking about conspiracy theory. Conspiracy theory are two people engaging in a criminal activity with a forethought, right? You know, deliberate and intent. That's a conspiracy, basically. And if you take the whole election steal, 2016 or 2022 or whatever side it is, whether it's Hillary or Trump or Biden or whoever's doing the talking at the time, there is nothing irrational per se in the concern about an election being interfered with or altered in some way by illegal means. If you break it down on that level, there's no reason to think that's crazy, because we know ballot boxes get stuffed. The question is, did ballot boxes get stuffed this time? By whom, and did it make a difference?
I think most people agree that obviously there's probably got to be an amount of election fraud, or there's got to be some type of influence from somewhere, whether it's another country or whether it's a private organization. But to even question that, it falls along the basis that a lot of people don't want to tread on, which means that you're being undemocratic and your beliefs, that the belief system of the democratic system is fair and it is legit and it's not influenced in any standards, which I just think is a dumb way of thinking, because I don't think we've really had a clear-cut example of real democratic policies in a long time. I think it's all about the circus, the bread and circus.
Well, you were talking about RFK a little while ago, RFK Jr.
They target him as much as Bernie Sanders.
And I watched an interview with him. I think it was either Al Jazeera or was MSNBC with someone. And he said that it kind of pains me to say it. But now, of course, he has a motive. I mean, he's not completely objective on this topic, obviously. But what he said is, he said, it pains me to say it, but I really think that what the Democratic Party want in 2024 is a coronation. And just running for the nomination, which everyone has an absolute right to do, if you're a member of the party, is being treated as almost like a form of treason or political deviance. And it's not. You can, all you have to say is, I obviously don't want Donald Trump to win. Everyone will be much better off if Donald Trump never becomes president again. But I think Joe Biden is a bad president, and I think he's a weak candidate. What's there to scream about that? Nothing. I mean, again, taken within its own terms. So what is the context, therefore, that explains the moral hysteria?
Well, because I think in a lot of people's minds, they only believe that there's going to be two candidates in the end, and it's going to be either Trump or Biden. There is no other option. So when you, if you denounce both of them, they just look at you like you're not understanding how the game is. It's going to be one or the other, and you have to choose the lesser of two evils. That was getting tossed out in the last election, the lesser of two evils.
Oh, yeah, and it'll be tossed out even more in this one. But the point is that the Democratic Party does not have to nominate Joe Biden. They could nominate Robert Kennedy Jr. They could nominate Gavin Newsom. Kamala Harris could be the candidate. They would have relative strengths and weaknesses too. But, you know, where was it? Has it been written that it has to be Joe Biden?
Why are they propping him up so much? They have so many other better ones.
It's right, exactly. Exactly, and that's the whole point, right? See, and I'm not passing a judgment about Joe Biden. I want to make it very clear. I'm talking about public speech and media representation of said public speech, including the speech we're engaging in right now. Right on YouTube. I mean, this is the thing. I said, if you break this objective content of the competing claims about whatever it is, there's a way of saying it that doesn't sound crazy, right? But why is the saying of it automatically become appropriated as the signifier of a host of seriously antisocial phenomena? How do we get to the point where an assertion of a contestable fact, there seem to have been some voting irregularities in Georgia in November 2020, okay? Just take that statement, right? Anyone could have said that. And it, you know, is it true or is it false? It could be completely false, totally falsifiable. I have no opinion. I have no stake in that. But the mere saying of it seems to be a taboo. And, you know, I think it's the same thing about, let's getting back to OJ so we can kind of, you know, maybe sort of begin to exit where we sort of entered, back to OJ. What really matters? If I go back to, you know, example that I use in law school, and a lot of law profs use it in their law classes. O.J. Simpson murdered both victims, Nicole Simpson Brown and Ron Goldman. He killed them, and by himself. There wasn't another party who could have complicated the causal sequence, the chain, right? He did it. But we also know that the LAPD committed perjury, lied, and either destroyed or faked evidence. We know that. Hypothetically, that, like, you know, a blood splatter that seems to indicate that it was released from a eyedropper rather than actually flying off a body, for example. For example, hypothetically, okay? Hypothetically, we have proven that the LAPD fabricated evidence. and lied about what they knew and what they did and did not do. Okay. What is the legally correct verdict? And the legally correct verdict is not guilty, because the onus is on the state. Because of the presumption of innocence, the burden of proof, due process, and the rule of law. You do not knowingly convict a person who has not received due process. He or she has been denied that. That means acquittal, even if in fact they did it. Okay. Do we believe that anymore as a society?
No.
Collectively. I agree with you. We don't believe that. Even when I say it, and I absolutely mean it. I mean it completely. I don't mean about the O.J. Simpson case in particular, what he did or did not do. I mean this as a principle, right? As a premise of legal reasoning. And I think legal morality, the morality of the law, in the sense that, remember, law and morality are not the same thing, but they're supposed to interface at certain crucial junctures, right? And this goes to the morality of the law. Why has it changed? Why is what I'm saying sounding a little like special pleading?
I think it's because it's the influence of the way society has gone. So there's more social, I guess, confusion when it gets brought into the way we do legal business now. Like, take Trump with the same charges of taking files compared to Biden having the same thing, taking files. People would want to see Trump go to jail, and then people would want to see Biden go free.
So is the issue an ulterior motive that's never spoken, which is, I don't care what it takes, put Donald Trump into prison. I don't care what it takes, acquit Joe Biden no matter what. So we don't give a damn about, in other words, there is no faith in process. There is no faith in objectivity. There is no faith in truth. There's only getting what you want, even if it's nothing more than a dopamine hit of immediate gratification.
But has that always been our judicial system, though?
Well, I'll tell you something, and I mentioned it in my book on René Girard, which everyone is absolutely free to buy a copy of after May 17th, 2024. I start my last chapter, which is basically my last chapter is a meditation on whether or not we're actually moving back to a scapegoating society. We're looking for ritualistic victims that we can slaughter as a means of appeasing something that has gone wrong that we cannot fix by any other means, or maybe not even fix at all. But we've got to provide ourselves with enough of a placebo that we can wake up the next morning and continue to function long enough until we have to do it all over again for the next placebo, right? And I said, there's this experiment I always used to do in first year law, and there's a lot of argument about who came up with this thought problem, whether it was David Hume or Thomas Jefferson or Benjamin Franklin or John Locke or John Stuart Mill, because a lot of people have used it. But basically, this is what it comes down to. You are in a situation that's never really been explained, but you are in this weird science fiction-like situation in which you're a judge, and you have before you, or let me put it this way, you're an appellate judge, and you're reviewing a conviction. And you have absolutely compelling, beyond any reasonable doubt whatsoever, that the plaintiff who's appealing his sentence is innocent. You know that this person has been wrongfully convicted, maybe wrongfully accused as well. Okay. However, the laws in your country stipulate that being an appellate judge, for every convict you release, you have to release 100 other prisoners as well. And it just so happens the only other 100 prisoners available that come within your circuit are all multiple repeat serial murderers. What do you do? Do you release the innocent man, enabling 100 guilty other men, I'll just say men, to go free? Or do you sacrifice or scapegoat the one innocent man to make sure that the 100 guilty men remain behind bars? what is the right decision? What is the correct vote? Which way to go, right? Now, when I started teaching law school full-time in the year 2000, I always ran that experiment in first-year law school because it's a classic first-year law school question. Mental hypothetical. I'm sorry, that's the wrong way to put it. It is a problem-solving exercise in legal reasoning.
Can I give my answer before you give your...
Sure.
I was going to say, I think it's definitely a moral conundrum, but it's not your life to gamble away. You can't really lock somebody up for the sense of moral capacity of the greater good by keeping 100 people behind the bars. I mean, it's a tough thing, but obviously, you know, it's not, I wouldn't consider it your responsibility that 100 people that should be locked up end up going free. I mean, if you look at the right choice, if a man's innocent and you're going to use him and throw him behind bars, and trust me, it's a very enticing thing to be like, hey, he's got to make the sacrifice. One of us has to. But if he doesn't want to be locked up, then it's like you're doing yourself. It's no different than letting the 100 men go free because you're still doing a wrong act either way. But this time you're ruining a person's life by locking him up behind bars. And then there's future thinking where it's like, well, about all the people that could be murdered by those 100 people? Well, I can't physically fucking see them. So,
well, that part of what goes on in your mind unconsciously or preconsciously when you're solving this problem or when you're formulating your answer. Right, because there's no necessarily right or wrong answer, is that you're weighing a certainty as opposed to a possibility. We know one innocent man is going to prison for the rest of his life. That is a fact. Will any of the 100 released men murder again? We don't know. Right? So you've got one certainty against 100 possibilities. That is a factor as well. But when I started the experiment, which, you know, again, thousands of law profs do this all over the world all the time, some version of this experiment. My first year classes overwhelmingly, I mean, close to 100% said, release the innocent man. They did what you did. And I kept on doing it. And I noticed that about the year 2007, 2008, it wasn't 100% anymore. I'd say by 2010, it was maybe one third were in favor of convicting the innocent man to keep the 100 guilty men locked up. And I think the last time I did the experiment in 2015 was about 50-50. So I stopped doing the experiment.
I wonder if that's because a lot more people are thinking about future things and future worrying as much. In therapy, they call it future tripping, which is when you're concerned about a problem that necessarily might not happen.
Yeah, I think AI has something to do with it, or all the hype about AI has something to do with that. In that, in fact, we can actually come up with compelling and convincing and reliable predictive mechanisms through algorithms and artificial intelligence. So we should be able to have much more certainty. In other words, we're going to make a hypothetical, we're going to make a possibility of certainty through more data. Right. And I think that's changed the cultural feel, the cultural expectations of things.
Well, AI is just another.
If you really believe you can do it, I'm not saying you can, but if you believe that you can, or shortly that we will, that is probably going to slant your thinking when it comes to questions like this. Well, we'll know whether or not the 100 men will or will not murder because we're all deterministic meat robots at the end of the day, and we'll be able to, and we get all the data and we'll figure out who's going to do what to whom when.
Do you think AI is just another way for us to solidify what our future is going to hold?
I think so. I mean, I think, well, let me put this way. I have very, very little faith in it.
I do too. I started getting freaked out when people talk about smart homes. Did you ever look into that? Where your homes can talk to you? And do things like that. That's a little bit strange. I mean, we already know our phones target us with advertising as private companies being influenced into our lives. So when you really examine things like AI, being able to kind of carve out what the future is going to be, then people don't feel the need to try and make their own adjustments or make their own thoughts on, oh, I don't need to worry about that because I know this is the correct answer because this machine told me. It's like, well, life's all about the unpredictability.
No, I think we're being more and more, it's not so much we're being trained to obey because we're always on some level being trained to obey. I think it's more like we're being trained to conform to future realities before they happen.
Yeah.
That seems to be a better way. If there's something new going on, I mean, that's every society needs its members to follow the rules because, you know, that's Thomas Hobbes, right? Otherwise, I think it'll break up after not too long. So at some level, we're stuck with a kind of a compelling utility for conformance and compliance. But I think what's happening change, and maybe that's why it's driving so many people insane very slowly, is that we're actually being encouraged to conform to things that haven't happened yet. So we're not worried about getting through the day. We're worried about today getting through next month on the basis of what we do today. Okay, I kind of have to go.
I know. I saw you looking down at your timer. Where can people find your links, Eric? I appreciate the time you gave me to talk today.
My book on René Girard is currently available online electronically at Springer Nature. And my book on Howard, with the F word in it, Howard's F-Pad, is available on Punctum Books. And there are a number of links there, including the announcement and the description of the text. So those are the two places. And if you need to talk to me, you can contact Punctum and they'll forward your request for an interview or just a query or a comment or a question to me.
Okay. Well, I'll make sure I link all your links in the description. It's been a pleasure chatting with you again. Thanks, everybody,
Thanks,
for listening
Robbie.
To this episode.
And really, now that I find out that Rip Robertson was your great uncle, I respect you
even
many
less.
Times more.
Okay.
No,
really?
No. Well, it goes the other way. Well, actually, I want to say the great line from Casablanca, you despise me, don't you, Rick? And he says, well, I despise you much less now. But I wasn't going to say that. That's just.
I didn't think you were going to do the voice, to be honest with you. You did a good.
Shitty impression anyway, but yeah, okay.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening to this episode of Out of the Blank. Stay tuned for our next episode.